Chapter 24. The sun is up. For a while I'm not sure where I am. We're on a road in a forest somewhere. Bad dream. That glass door again. The chrome of the cycle gleams beside me, and then I see the pines, and then Idaho comes to mind. The door and the shadowy figure beside it were just imaginary. We're on a logging road, that's right. Bright day, sparkling air. Wow, it's beautiful. We're headed for the ocean. I remember the dream again, and the words I'll see you at the bottom of the ocean, and wonder about them. But pines and sunlight are stronger than any dream, and the wondering goes away. Good old reality. I get out of the sleeping bag. It's cold, and I get dressed quickly. Chris is asleep. I walk around him, climb over a fallen tree trunk, and walk up the logging road. To warm myself, I speed up to a jog and move up the road briskly. Good, 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 good. The word keeps time with the jogging. Some birds fly up from the shadowy hill into the sunlight, and I watch them until they're out of sight. Good, 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 good. Crunchy gravel on the road. Good, good. Bright yellow sand in the sun. Good, good, good. These roads go on for miles sometimes. Good, good, good. Eventually, I reach a point where I'm really winded. The road is higher now, and I can see for miles over the forest. Good. Still puffing, I walk back down at a brisk pace, crunching more gently now, noticing small plants and shrubs where the pines have been logged. At the cycle again, I pack gently and quickly. By now, I'm so familiar with how everything goes together, it's almost done without thought. Finally, I need Chris's sleeping bag. I roll him a little, not too rough, and tell him, "Great day." He looks around, disoriented. He gets out of the sleeping bag, and while I pack it, gets dressed without really knowing what he does. "Put your sweater and jacket on," I say. "It's going to be a chilly ride." He does, and gets on, and in low gear, we follow the logging road down to where it meets the blacktop again. Before we start on it, I take one last look back up. Nice. A nice spot. From here, the blacktop winds down and down. Long Chautauqua today. One that I've been looking forward to during the whole trip. Second gear, and then third. Not too fast in these curves. Beautiful sunlight on these forests. There has been a haze, a backup problem in this Chautauqua so far. I talked about caring the first day and then realized I couldn't say anything meaningful about caring until its inverse side, quality, is understood. I think it's important now to tie care to quality by pointing out that care and quality are internal and external aspects of the same thing. A person who sees quality and feels it as he works is a person who cares. A person who cares about what he sees and does is a person who's bound to have some characteristics of quality. Thus, if the problem of technological hopelessness is caused by absence of care, both by technologists and anti-technologists, and if care and quality are external and internal aspects of the same thing, then it follows logically that what really causes technological hopelessness is absence of the perception of quality in technology by both technologists and anti-technologists. Phaedrus's mad pursuit of the rational, analytic, and therefore technological meaning of the word quality was really a pursuit of the answer to the whole problem of technological hopelessness. So it seems to me, anyway. So I backed up and shifted to the classic romantic split that I think underlies the whole humanist technological problem. But that, too, required a backup into the meaning of quality. But to understand the meaning of quality in classic terms required a backup into metaphysics and its relationship to everyday life. To do that required still another backup into the huge area that relates both metaphysics and everyday life, namely formal reason. So I proceeded with formal reason up into metaphysics and then into quality, and then from quality, back down into metaphysics and science. Now we go still further down from science into technology. And I do believe that at last we are where I wanted to be in the first place. But now we have with us some concepts that greatly alter the whole understanding of things. Quality is the Buddha. Quality is scientific reality. Quality is the goal of art. It remains to work these concepts into a practical, down-to-earth context, and for this there is nothing more practical or down-to-earth than what I have been talking about all along. The repair of an old motorcycle. This road keeps on winding down through this canyon. Early morning patches of sun are around us everywhere. The cycle hums through the cold air and mountain pines, and we pass a small sign that says a breakfast place is a mile ahead. "Are you hungry?" I shout. "Yes," Chris shouts back. Soon a second sign saying cabins with an arrow under it points off to the left. We slow down, turn, and follow a dirt road until it reaches some varnished log cabins under some trees. We pull the cycle under a tree, shut off the ignition and gas, and walk inside the main lodge. The wooden floors have a nice clump under the cycle boots. We sit down at a tablecloth table and order eggs, hot cakes, maple syrup, milk, sausages, and orange juice. That cold wind has worked up an appetite. "I want to write a letter to Mom," Chris says. "That sounds good to me." I go to the desk and get some of the lodge stationery. I bring it to Chris and give him my pen. That brisk morning air has given him some energy, too. He puts the paper in front of him, grabs the pen in a heavy grip, and then concentrates on the blank paper for a while. He looks up. "What day is it?" I tell him. He nods and writes it down. Then I see him write, "Dear Mom." Then he stares at the paper for a while. Then he looks up. "What should I say?" I start to grin. I should have him write for an hour about one side of a coin. I sometimes thought of him as a student, but not as a rhetoric student. We're interrupted by the hotcakes, and I tell him to put the letter to one side, and I'll help him afterward. When we are done, I sit smoking with a leaden feeling from the hotcakes and the eggs and everything, and notice through the window that under the pines outside, the ground is in patches of shadow and sunlight. Chris brings out the paper again. "Now help me," he says. "Okay," I say. I tell him getting stuck is the commonest trouble of all. Usually, I say, your mind gets stuck when you're trying to do too many things at once. What you have to do is try not to force words to come. That just gets you more stuck. What you have to do now is separate out the things and do them one at a time. You're trying to think of what to say and what to say first at the same time. And that's too hard. So separate them out. Just make a list of all the things you want to say in any old order. Then later we'll figure out the right order. "Like what things?" he asks. "Well, what do you want to tell her?" "About the trip." "What things about the trip?" He thinks for a while. "About the mountain we climbed." "Okay, write that down," I say. He does. Then I see him write down another item, then another, while I finish my cigarette and coffee. He goes through three sheets of paper listing things he wants to say. "Save those," I tell him, "and we'll work on them later." "I'll never get all this into one letter," he says. He sees me laugh and frowns. I say, "Just pick out the best things." Then we head outside and onto the motorcycle again. On the road down the canyon now, we feel the steady drop of altitude by a popping of ears. It's becoming warmer, and the air is thicker, too. It's goodbye to the high country, which we've been more or less in since Miles City. Stuckness. That's what I want to talk about today. Back in our trip out of Miles City, you'll remember I talked about how formal scientific method could be applied to the repair of a motorcycle through the study of chains of cause and effect and the application of experimental method to determine these chains. The purpose then was to show what was meant by classic rationality. Now I want to show that that classic pattern of rationality can be tremendously improved, expanded, and made far more effective through the formal recognition of quality in its operation. Before doing this, however, I should go over some of the negative aspects of traditional maintenance to show just where the problems are. The first is stuckness, a mental stuckness that accompanies the physical stuckness of whatever it is you're working on. The same thing Chris was suffering from. A screw sticks, for example, on a side cover assembly. You check the manual to see if there might be any special cause for this screw to come off so hard, but all it says is, remove side cover plate in that wonderful terse technical style that never tells you what you want to know. There's no earlier procedure left undone that might cause the cover screws to stick. If you're experienced, you'd probably apply a penetrating liquid and an impact driver at this point. But suppose you're inexperienced, and you attach a self-locking plier wrench to the shank of your screwdriver and really twist it hard, a procedure you've had success with in the past, but which this time succeeds only in tearing the slot of the screw. Your mind was already thinking ahead to what you would do when the cover plate was off, and so it takes a little time to realize that this irritating minor annoyance of a torn screw slot isn't just irritating and minor. You're stuck, stopped, terminated. It's absolutely stopped you from fixing the motorcycle. This isn't a rare scene in science or technology. This is the commonest scene of all. Just plain stuck. In traditional maintenance, this is the worst of all moments, so bad that you have avoided even thinking about it before you come to it. The book's no good to you now. Neither is scientific reason. You don't need any scientific experiments to find out what's wrong. It's obvious what's wrong. What you need is an hypothesis for how you're going to get that slotless screw out of there, and scientific method doesn't provide any of these hypotheses. It operates only after they're around. This is the zero moment of consciousness. Stuck. No answer. Honked. Kaput. It's a miserable experience emotionally. You're losing time. You're incompetent. You don't know what you're doing. You should be ashamed of yourself. You should take the machine to a real mechanic who knows how to figure these things out. It's normal at this point for the fear-anger syndrome to take over and make you want to hammer on that side plate with a chisel, to pound it off with a sledge if necessary. You think about it, and the more you think about it, the more you're inclined to take the whole machine to a high bridge and drop it off. It's just outrageous that a tiny little slot of a screw can defeat you so totally. What you're up against is the great unknown, the void of all Western thought. You need some ideas, some hypotheses. Traditional scientific method, unfortunately, has never quite gotten around to saying exactly where to pick up more of these hypotheses. Traditional scientific method has always been at the very best 20/20 hindsight. It's good for seeing where you've been. It's good for testing the truth of what you think you know. But it can't tell you where you ought to go, unless where you ought to go is a combination of where you were going in the past. Creativity, originality, inventiveness, intuition, imagination, unstuckness, in other words, are completely outside its domain. We continue down the canyon, past folds in the steep slopes where wide streams enter. We notice the river grows rapidly now as streams enlarge it. Turns in the road are less sharp here, and straight stretches are longer. I move into the highest gear. Later, the trees become scarce and spindly, with large areas of grass and underbrush between them. It's too hot for the jacket and sweater, so I stop at a roadside pull-off to remove them. Chris wants to go hiking up a trail, and I let him, finding a small shady spot to sit back and rest. Just quiet now and meditative. A display describes a fire burn that took place here years ago. According to the information, the forest is filling in again, but it will be years before it returns to its former condition. Later, the crunch of gravel tells me Chris is coming back down the trail. He didn't go very far. When he arrives, he says, "Let's go." We retie the pack, which has started to shift a little, and then move out on the highway. The sweat from sitting there cools suddenly from the wind. We're still stuck on that screw, and the only way it's going to get unstuck is by abandoning further examination of the screw according to traditional scientific method. That won't work. What we have to do is examine traditional scientific method in the light of that stuck screw. We've been looking at that screw objectivity. According to the doctrine of objectivity, which is integral with traditional scientific method, what we like or don't like about that screw has nothing to do with our correct thinking. We should not evaluate what we see. We should keep our mind a blank tablet, which nature fills for us, and then reason disinterestedly from the facts we observe. But when we stop and think about it disinterestedly, in terms of this stuck screw, we begin to see that this whole idea of disinterested observation is silly. Where are those facts? What are we going to observe disinterestedly? The torn slot? The immovable side cover plate? The color of the paint job? The speedometer? The sissy bar? As Poincaré would have said, there are an infinite number of facts about the motorcycle, and the right ones don't just dance up and introduce themselves. The right facts, the ones we really need, are not only passive, they are damned elusive. And we're not going to just sit back and observe them. We're going to have to be in there looking for them, or we're going to be here a long time. Forever. As Poincaré pointed out, there must be a subliminal choice of what facts we observe. The difference between a good mechanic and a bad one, like the difference between a good mathematician and a bad one, is precisely this ability to select the good facts from the bad ones on the basis of quality. He has to care. This is an ability about which formal traditional scientific method has nothing to say. It's long past time to take a closer look at this qualitative preselection of facts, which has seemed so scrupulously ignored by those who make so much of these facts after they are observed. I think that it will be found that a formal acknowledgement of the role of quality in the scientific process doesn't destroy the empirical vision at all. It expands it, strengthens it, and brings it far closer to actual scientific practice. I think the basic fault that underlies the problem of stuckness is traditional rationality's insistence upon objectivity, a doctrine that there is a divided reality of subject and object. For true science to take place, these must be rigidly separate from each other. You are the mechanic. There is the motorcycle. You are forever apart from one another. You do this to it. You do that to it. These will be the results. This eternally dualistic subject-object way of approaching the motorcycle sounds right to us because we're used to it. But it's not right. It's always been an artificial interpretation superimposed on reality. It's never been reality itself. When this duality is completely accepted, a certain non-divided relationship between the mechanic and motorcycle, a craftsman-like feeling for the work, is destroyed. When traditional rationality divides the world into subjects and objects, it shuts out quality. And when you're really stuck, it's quality, not any subjects or objects, that tells you where you ought to go. By returning our attention to quality, it is hoped that we can get technological work out of the non-caring subject-object dualism and back into craftsman-like, self-involved reality again, which will reveal to us the facts we need when we are stuck. In my mind now is an image of a huge, long railroad train, one of those 120 boxcar jobs that cross the prairies all the time with lumber and vegetables going east, and with automobiles and other manufactured goods going west. I want to call this railroad train knowledge, and subdivide it into two parts, classic knowledge and romantic knowledge. In terms of the analogy, classic knowledge, the knowledge taught by the Church of Reason, is the engine and all the boxcars. All of them and everything that's in them. If you subdivide the train into parts, you will find no romantic knowledge anywhere. And unless you're careful, it's easy to make the presumption that's all the train there is. This isn't because romantic knowledge is non-existent or even unimportant. It's just that so far, the definition of the train is static and purposeless. This was what I was trying to get at back in South Dakota when I talked about two whole dimensions of existence. It's two whole ways of looking at the train. Romantic quality, in terms of this analogy, isn't any part of the train. It's the leading edge of the engine. a two-dimensional surface of no real significance unless you understand that the train isn't a static entity at all. A train really isn't a train if it can't go anywhere. In the process of examining the train and subdividing it into parts, we've inadvertently stopped it, so that it really isn't a train we are examining. That's why we get stuck. The real train of knowledge isn't a static entity that can be stopped and subdivided. It's always going somewhere, on a track called quality. And that engine and all those 120 boxcars are never going anywhere except where the track of quality takes them. And romantic quality, the leading edge of the engine, takes them along that track. Romantic reality is the cutting edge of experience. It's the leading edge of the train of knowledge that keeps the whole train on the track. Traditional knowledge is only the collective memory of where that leading edge has been. At the leading edge, there are no subjects, no objects, only the track of quality ahead. And if you have no formal way of evaluating, no way of acknowledging this quality, then the entire train has no way of knowing where to go. You don't have pure reason, you have pure confusion. The leading edge is where absolutely all the action is. The leading edge contains all the infinite possibilities of the future. It contains all the history of the past. Where else could they be contained? The past cannot remember the past. The future can't generate the future. The cutting edge of this instant right here and now is always nothing less than the totality of everything there is. Value, the leading edge of reality, is no longer an irrelevant offshoot of structure. Value is the predecessor of structure. It's the pre-intellectual awareness that gives rise to it. Our structured reality is pre-selected on the basis of value. And really, to understand structured reality requires an understanding of the value source from which it's derived. One's rational understanding of a motorcycle is therefore modified from minute to minute as one works on it, and sees that a new and different rational understanding has more quality. One doesn't cling to old, sticky ideas because one has an immediate rational basis for rejecting them. Reality isn't static anymore. It's not a set of ideas you have to either fight or resign yourself to. It's made up, in part, of ideas that are expected to grow as you grow, and as we all grow, century after century. With quality as a central undefined term, reality is, in its essential nature, not static, but dynamic. And when you really understand dynamic reality, you never get stuck. It has forms, but the forms are capable of change. To put it in more concrete terms, if you want to build a factory or fix a motorcycle or set a nation right without getting stuck, then classical, structured, dualistic subject-object knowledge, although necessary, isn't enough. You have to have some feeling for the quality of the work. You have to have a sense of what's good. That is what carries you forward. This sense isn't just something you're born with, although you are born with it. It's also something you can develop. It's not just intuition, not just unexplainable skill or talent. It's the direct result of contact with basic reality, quality, which dualistic reason has in the past tended to conceal. It all sounds so far out and esoteric when it's put like that, it comes as a shock to discover that it is one of the most homespun, down-to-earth views of reality you can have. Harry Truman, of all people, comes to mind when he said, concerning his administration's programs, "We'll just try them. And if they don't work, why, then we'll just try something else." That may not be an exact quote, but it's close. "The reality of the American government isn't static," he said. "It's dynamic. If we don't like it, well, we'll get something better." The American government isn't going to get stuck in any set of fancy doctrinaire ideas. The key word is better. Quality. Some may argue that the underlying form of the American government is stuck, is incapable of change in response to quality. But that argument is not to the point. The point is that the president and everyone else, from the wildest radical to the wildest reactionary, agree that the government should change in response to quality, even if it doesn't. Peters's concept of changing quality as reality, a reality so omnipotent that whole governments must change to keep up with it, is something that, in a wordless way, we have always unanimously believed in all along. And what Harry Truman said, really, was nothing different from the practical, pragmatic attitude of any laboratory scientist or any engineer or any mechanic when he's not thinking objectively in the course of his daily work. I keep talking wild theory, but it keeps somehow coming out stuff everybody knows, folklore. This quality, this feeling for the work, is something known in every shop. Now, finally, let's get back to that screw. Let's consider a reevaluation of the situation in which we assume that the stuckness now occurring, the zero of consciousness, isn't the worst of all possible situations, but the best possible situation you could be in. After all, it's exactly this stuckness that Zen Buddhists go to so much trouble to induce, through koans, deep breathing, sitting still, and the like. Your mind is empty. You have a hollow, flexible attitude of beginner's mind. You're right at the front end of the train of knowledge, at the track of reality itself. Consider for a change that this is a moment to be not feared, but cultivated. If your mind is truly profoundly stuck, then you may be much better off than when it was loaded with ideas. The solution to the problem often at first seems unimportant or undesirable, but the state of stuckness allows it, in time, to assume its true importance. It seemed small because your previous rigid evaluation, which led to the stuckness, made it small. But now consider the fact that no matter how hard you try to hang on to it, this stuckness is bound to disappear. Your mind will naturally and freely move toward a solution. Unless you are a real master at staying stuck, you can't prevent this. The fear of stuckness is needless, because the longer you stay stuck, the more you see the quality reality that gets you unstuck every time. What's really been getting you stuck is the running from the stuckness through the cars of your train of knowledge, looking for a solution that is out in front of the train. Stuckness shouldn't be avoided. It's the physic predecessor of all real understanding. An egoless acceptance of stuckness is a key to an understanding of all quality, in mechanical work as in other endeavors. It's this understanding of quality, as revealed by stuckness, which so often makes self-taught mechanics so superior to institute-trained men who have learned how to handle everything except a new situation. Normally, screws are so cheap and small and simple you think of them as unimportant. But now, as your quality awareness becomes stronger, you realize that this one individual particular screw is neither cheap nor small nor unimportant. Right now, this screw is worth exactly the selling price of the whole motorcycle, because the motorcycle is actually valueless until you get the screw out. With this reevaluation of the screw comes a willingness to expand your knowledge of it. With the expansion of the knowledge, I would guess, would come a reevaluation of what the screw really is. If you concentrate on it, think about it, stay stuck on it for a long enough time, I would guess that in time you will come to see that the screw is less and less an object typical of a class and more an object unique in itself. Then, with more concentration, you'll begin to see the screw as not even an object at all, but as a collection of functions. Your stuckness is gradually eliminating patterns of traditional reason. In the past, when you separated subject and object from one another in a permanent way, your thinking about them got very rigid. You formed a class called screw that seemed to be inviolable and more real than the reality you are looking at. And you couldn't think of how to get unstuck because you couldn't think of anything new, because you couldn't see anything new. Now, in getting that screw out, you aren't interested in what it is. What it is has ceased to be a category of thought and is a continuing direct experience. It's not in the boxcars anymore. It's out in front and capable of change. You are interested in what it does and why it's doing it. You will ask functional questions. Associated with your questions will be a subliminal quality discrimination, identical to the quality discrimination that led Poincaré to the Fuchsian equations. What your actual solution is unimportant as long as it has quality. Thoughts about the screw as combined rigidness and adhesiveness and about its special helical interlock might lead naturally to solutions of impaction and use of solvents. That is one kind of quality track. Another track may be to go to the library and look through a catalog of mechanics tools in which you might come across a screw extractor that would do the job, or to call a friend who knows something about mechanical work, or to just drill the screw out or just burn it out with a torch. Or you might just, as a result of your meditative attention to the screw, come up with some new way of extracting it that has never been thought of before and that beats all the rest and is patentable and makes you a millionaire 5 years from now. There's no predicting what's on that quality track. The solutions all are simple after you have arrived at them, but they're simple only when you know already what they are. Highway 13 follows another branch of our river, but now it goes upstream past old sawmill towns and sleepy scenery. Sometimes when you switch from a federal to a state highway, it seems like you drop back like this in time. Pretty mountains, pretty river, bumpy but pleasant tar road, old buildings, old people on a front porch. Strange how old, obsolete buildings and plants and mills, the technology of 50 and 100 years ago, always seem to look so much better than the new stuff. Weeds and grass and wildflowers grow where the concrete is cracked and broken. Neat, squared, upright lines acquire a random sag. The uniform masses of the unbroken color of fresh paint modify to a mottled, weathered softness. Nature has a non-Euclidean geometry of her own that seems to soften the deliberate objectivity of these buildings with a kind of random spontaneity that architects would do well to study. Soon we leave the river and the old sleepy buildings and now climb to some sort of a dry, meadowy plateau. The road rolls and bumps and rocks so much I have to keep the speed down to 50. There are some bad chuck holes in the asphalt, and I watch carefully for more. We're really accustomed to making mileage. Stretches that would have seemed long back in the Dakotas now seem short and easy. Being on the machine seems more natural than being off it. We're nowhere that I'm familiar with, in country that I've never seen before, yet I don't feel a stranger in it. At the top of the plateau at Grangeville, Idaho, we step from the blasting heat into an air-conditioned restaurant. Deep cool inside. While we wait for chocolate malteds, I notice a high schooler sitting at the counter exchanging looks with the girl next to him. She's gorgeous, and I'm not the only other one who notices it. The girl behind the counter waiting on them is also watching, with an anger she thinks no one else sees. Some kind of triangle. We keep passing unseen through little moments of other people's lives. Back in the heat again, and not far from Grangeville, we see that the dry plateau that looked almost like prairie when we were out on it suddenly breaks away into an enormous canyon. I see our road will go down and down through what must be 100 hairpin turns into a desert of broken land and crags. I tap Chris's knee and point, and as we round a turn, where we see it all, I hear him holler, "Wow!" At the brink, I shift down to third, then close the throttle. The engine drags, backfiring a little, and down we go. By the time our cycle has reached the bottom of wherever it is we have dropped thousands of feet. I look back over my shoulder and see ant-like cars way back at the top. Now we must head forward across this baking desert to wherever the road leads.